The Colorado Office of Behavioral Health oversees more than 1,000 cases of child physical abuse, sexual abuse, and neglect. In addition, the office also administers the state's two mental health hospitals while providing training and technical assistance to behavioral health providers. Greetings again. I'm Adam Morgan. One principal focus of the office is at the intersection of criminal justice and mental health. A study found that over half of prison and jail inmates have mental health challenges. This includes a majority of the youth and children in the juvenile justice system having mental health conditions. On this edition, we continue learning more on how the Colorado Office of Behavioral Health is working to better manage mental health conditions for all levels of the incarcerated. Our guest again is the director of the office, Ms. Leora Joseph.
Right now in Colorado, while there are, you know, serious mental health needs for many of our juveniles, the issue of severe mental illness and the juvenile criminal issue is not the much of the focal point right now.
Yeah.
And make sure, I want to be very intentional. Our juveniles need all the support we can give them. And that includes mental health treatment and counseling. But the instance of severe, severe mental illness, like I'm talking about in this call, is not as much of an issue with our juvenile population right now.
I know you probably sit at your desk and you see all the news stories and everybody saying, you know, we have to do more in the mental health area to support our youth. And what's it going to be and where are we going to go? And you're sitting there saying, we're already there. Probably needs to be extended to those in high school, at least the symptoms there are, so they can be taken care of before that youth commits a crime.
100%. Please don't hear me say we don't need to do anything more. There needs to be full attention paid to our youth in every spectrum, making sure there's equity across the state in terms of their educational opportunities, their opportunities to access treatment before they get involved in the criminal justice system. To me, that is the most important part. Do our youth have ability to get help before things progress in a negative way? I know Colorado's taken some amazing steps. Right now, there's a bill was passed a couple of years ago, I believe by Senator Michelson Janay, that created mental health treatment for students all across Colorado. I think that's a huge beginning step. I think educating people and families about mental illness, I think helping educators, our teachers are frontline workers, and we have got to support them and see what kind of services and training they want on the issue of mental health and what to do if they see behavior that is concerning to them. So I think that there is a lot more we can do as a state in that area.
What do you say to parents? And I ask that question because you just mentioned that the mental health workers are first line. They're there. And parents sometimes throw their hands up because I'm not equipped to do this. I don't know anything about this. And they go watch the game and try to forget about it. Is there one or two pieces of advice you can give to parents to not do that and to pay attention to what they can do, even though they may not be trained in the mental health area?
So you're raising the area that has been the most painful for me since I began this job. There are a group of parents that I have met with every few months, and it is the most heartbreaking of meetings. And this is a group of parents that all tell me the basic following story, that they had a child who went through life and they thought everything was, you know, quote unquote, going well and healthy. And then as soon as the child hits that early 20s and is no longer a minor, they begin to exhibit these examples of severe mental illness, some strong paranoia, refusing to bathe, refusing to eat, refusing to clean themselves or brush teeth, and beginning a journey and a rapid descent. It can be onset at age 21, and by 24, they're living on the street. And these are parents that meet with me to talk about how this journey has been so painful and fraught with challenge and emotion. I'm actually meeting with some people over the weekend who just called me out of the blue to ask if they could talk because this is what's happening with their son.
Yeah.
And I want to help and talk people through the systems. Unfortunately, what's happened is because they are no longer a minor, they can't be forced into treatment anywhere. And so we need the person who, at 20, you're an adult. And we need those people to, the people who are sick, to say, I'm sick and I need help. Independent of that, right now, what ends up happening is that they get arrested for these low-level crimes that you and I have just been talking about, and now they're in the criminal justice system. And it's a whole cycle that gets and raises competency. And this is where we need to change things. Our jails cannot become our de facto mental health treatment centers. That's right. Crazy. So what we need to do and make sure we have resources for parents, and this is one of the projects I hope to tackle over the next year, how do we help parents identify early on that they have a child with severe mental illness? What are those signs and symptoms? And then when they do, who do they go to? Who do they talk to? How do we get quick, fast, efficient, good mental health care that is covered by insurance for everybody so we can stem this early on and we can help people recognize the symptoms, we can help people get treatment, we can help people get into therapy and use our civil system and not our criminal system in order to heal people and help them have productive lives.
What you're saying is there are alternatives to jail. And we do spend a lot of time criminalizing our mental illness in America. So we need to decriminalize and let people know that there are alternatives for those who need help.
We need to focus on treatment, and how to disentangle people who are very sick from the criminal justice system.
I guess the other direction I need to go right now, is there a difference in the mental health needs for incarcerated African-American, Latino, or indigenous populations who may have to be managed a little more culturally, I'd say?
I think culturally sensitive treatment is at the core of the work that needs to happen. I think that, we have to look at our jail populations and see what the backgrounds are. In the area of severe mental illness, we are beginning to collect data on these exact issues that you're talking about. And one thing I can raise with you is that what we do know about our competency population is that about half of them are people experiencing homelessness. So we're really hyper-focused right now on that relationship between homelessness, mental illness, criminal justice, that trifecta, and how to create alternative court systems to hold people accountable and make sure they're getting treatment, but not using the jails.
I'm synthesizing what you just said there, especially regarding homelessness. It's almost as if you, in order to better affect their homelessness, you have to strengthen their mental health. Otherwise, they won't know what they're getting.
I think we need there's a population that needs treatment and housing. And, you can't get better if you're out on the street from any disease, right? Think about any disease, God forbid. Any disease, you need housing, clean and safe housing. But for many people, we also need to make sure they're getting treatment.
Because we hear all the stories about, getting them into rooms and motels and redone office space and all that. But if you don't give them some mental health treatment for some of them, they'll be right back on the street again.
I want to make it clear that not all people experiencing homelessness are mentally ill. That's not what I'm saying.
Right. I'm not saying that either, but there are some. And we need to figure out who they are along with those who are not. I'm just guessing.
Right, exactly.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to touch base on was that, and I couldn't get it clear, that there are some initiatives that people need to know about. A lot of them know about the suicide line and crisis lifeline, but they're also community behavioral health clinics that they can help their loved one, perhaps, or who may have been incarcerated, who's now released and still needs some support there. Are there some initiatives that you know of that you can share with us that the public needs to know about that they can benefit from?
Absolutely. Listen, community mental health is where it's at. That is the key and the secret sauce so that people can be treated in their homes, in their communities, and not institutionalized. And so strengthening those community mental health systems is one of the goals of the newly established Behavioral Health Administration, the BHA, which is scheduled to go live, I think, July 1st. Uh-huh. Of, is it 2024 or 2025? I don't know.
Yeah, they're in operation now, but they're still sort of ramping up their operations.
Yes, they exist now, but they're really working hard to, you know, make sure it's throughout the state and all of that. So I think that we are very big fans of the community mental health system. We work with a lot of different providers, and I think they are the ones doing a lot of this work. When I talk about outpatient restoration, that's what I'm talking about.
The other question I need to ask you about is loneliness. Does loneliness as a mental health issue come up among the incarcerated that you know of?
I can't imagine that it wouldn't. I can't imagine a more lonely issue. And one of the issues that we are concerned about is how do we cure for mental illness? And I think being in solitary and in solitude doesn't help. We've learned that over the pandemic, that's just kind of increased people's sicknesses.
Yeah, now I know you're not a psychologist, but I know you have a lot of information. You find out a lot of information from those guys and ladies. Have they seen that loneliness sometimes can be a factor in leading or driving people to commit a crime or something which lands them in the criminal justice system? And I ask you that because there's so many seniors that are lonely, and some of them are starting to do petty theft and stuff like that. And so that's how I'm asking you about the effect of loneliness on incarcerated populations, because if they're lonely now, they're going to be more lonely once they're behind bars.
I have not seen any, you know, data specifically studying the effects of loneliness and the criminogenic behavior. I would love to talk more about it and do a deep dive into that.
Mm-hmm. I guess one final thing, we don't have to assume anymore, but that mental health treatment does affect sentencing for those adults that are in the system, as what the judge wants to do and how he wants to do it.
I think that when many of our competency patients are restored to competency, the judge is content with their treatment plan, and they can take a plea in their case and be released. I think that is that's a result we see.
And your department is fairly new to the state then, and it's coming to being. You have 1,800 people you have to oversee. So it would seem like we should have known more about it outside of the press release that kicked you off.
Well, I'm really glad that you're calling about it now. So all of this work, all of the work at the state level in the area of mental health used to be under one big office called the Office of Behavioral Health. Mm-hmm. And they undertook everything that the BHA is doing and then everything that my office is doing. The Office of Behavioral Health would then split into two, and my office became a newly named part of it back in the fall of 22, or 23, I think it was. Fall of 2022. And in fall of 2022, we renamed ourselves the Office of Civil and Forensic Mental Health. But this is the work that has been going on for years. We're just trying to really streamline the effort. This is the work that runs both state hospital, which of course have been operational for many, many, many years. And this is the work that runs the programming in the jail, which has also been going on for a dozen years or so. So these programs have existed. We've just kind of renamed the organization and reprioritized under direct care work that is involved with people with severe mental illness involved in the court system.
Final question for you. Is there anything the public can do to help support the work that you all do there? There's a lot of people looking for volunteerism and to get involved with civic things. Is there anything people can directly do which can help your department do its work better?
Wow, that's such a kind question. I think that people getting educated on the issues, I think removing the stigmas around mental health and mental health treatment, encouraging people who aren't well to get help, not to be ashamed of having a mental health diagnosis, make sure people are talking about it and people understand the issues. I think that is a huge piece of making some success here.
Ms. Leora Joseph, Director of the Colorado Office of Behavioral Health, working to better support the mental health situations of the incarcerated. Many thanks to her again for being our guest for this edition. I'm Adam Morgan. Do stay in touch, and many thanks to you as well for sharing a few moments of your weekend with us.